This is sort of a magical kind of story. Happened somewhere in some small town some time ago when a carnival used to come to town. Carnivals that have rides, and they'd have pony rides for kids and games to play, and you throw darts to break balloons, and you know those things. And one of the shows in the midway at the carnival was this very strange old man who wore a long pointed cap like a wizard. And he called himself a wizard. Now that's not what everyone called him, but it's what he called himself. And he had a very strange game of chance that he played. He had a table out in front of him, and scattered out on the table were some very odd things. One was a little walnut shell upside down, sitting on the table. Another was a fine old teacup with a crack out of it, sitting upside down. Then there was a very small, very nice old woman's purse made with lots and lots of beads on it and a little gold snap on the top. And finally, there was a cowboy hat sitting on the table. And he would move these four things around on the table, and people would place bets. And they'd pick one of those things, and after the bet was placed, they would get to lift up or open the one they'd picked, and they'd get whatever was in it, whether it was good or bad. It's a very odd game. Once someone picked the teacup, and they lifted up the teacup, and there were two gold coins under it. And they went away very happy, and they said, "The man is truly a wizard, and a wonderful man to boot." But the next time somebody picked up the teacup, a big ugly spider ran out from under it and bit them. Ow, that's what they said. They said more than that, too. And they said, "This man isn't a wizard at all, he's a charlatan. He's just fooling him. He's a crook. He's a quack. He's a charlatan." And sometimes someone would pick the cowboy hat, and underneath the cowboy hat they would find this wonderful necklace of emeralds worth thousands and thousands of dollars. And they'd go away very happy, and they'd say, "Oh, you're really a great wizard." But once someone picked the cowboy hat, and as soon as they lifted it up, a snake shot out from under it and bit them, and they died on the spot. You think it's funny. This was a heck of a game. Well, one of the people watching, and he didn't play, but he watched, was a boy about 7 years old. And he stood there at the table all day long, and he was just amazed at what this old wizard was doing. He couldn't understand how things appeared under the hat or the cup or in the purse. And he couldn't understand why sometimes they were good and why sometimes they were bad. But he was just amazed at this. And at night, after all the people had gone and the game had stopped, and some had won and said the old man was a wizard, and some had lost and said he was a charlatan or worse, the little boy stood there at the side of the table, and he reached in his pocket, and he took out everything he had in his pocket. He put it on the table, and he said, and he pushed it across the table to the wizard, and he said, "Here's my pocket knife and 37 cents and a picture of me and my family. These are the most precious things in the whole world to me. Take them. I want you to teach me how to be a wizard." And the old man looked at him and got very sad, and he said, "Oh," he pushed the things back. He said, "Take your things back." He said, "I can't teach you to be a wizard." He said, "I'm really just a charlatan." And the little boy wouldn't believe him. And he said, "No, it's not true." He said, "I've seen what you do." He said, "Sometimes emeralds appear and gold coins appear, and sometimes spiders and snakes appear, but it's all pretty amazing." He said, "There's a great power here." And he said, "I want you to teach it to me." And the old man said, "There is a great power here, but," he said, "I couldn't teach it to you if I tried." He said, "I don't understand it myself." He said, "I inherited these things, this cup and purse and hat and the old walnut shell." And he said, "I just moved them around like I was taught to move them around." And he said, "Sometimes wonderful things happen and sometimes bad things happen. Most of the time, nothing happens at all." And he said, I don't understand a bit of it. He said, I'm really just a charlatan. And the little boy wouldn't believe him. He said, no. He said, that's not true. He said, there's a great power here, and you have it. I want you to teach it to me. And he pushed all his things back across the table again. The old man looked down at them, and he said, I can teach you, but if I teach you to become a wizard, you'll become a charlatan too. Because the two go together, and they cannot be separated. And he said, what do you think of that? And the little boy looked up at him with a big smile, and he said, I can work weekends. And that's the end. During the summer, I'm trying to visit some of the other churches in the area to see what works and what's worth trying. 2 weeks ago, I visited Riverbend Church, and I'd recommend it to you. And I listened to Gerald Mann preach. He's the man around whom and by whom the church was built. For me, his religion was not big enough, but his preaching style certainly was. So I thought, this is a church where it's safe to fail. And after 15 years of preaching with carefully prepared manuscripts, I decided to try it Gerald Mann style this morning and see how it works. Now, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, can you really talk about all the balderdash in the world in just one sermon? And I can't, because there's too much of it. Usually to get into sermons, you find something, a story, an insight, a sound bite even, to give you a way to open the door into the subject. And usually they tend to be from fairly classy sources. But not this morning. This morning I want to take an insight from those great, seldom recognized philosophers of our society, those in the world of professional wrestling. They have a distinction that I think is useful and might be helpful in talking about balderdash. In the world of professional wrestling, they divide the whole world into two categories, which they call the smarts and the marks. The marks are the ones who actually think professional wrestling is an athletic contest and wonder who will win. The smarts know that what they're seeing is a loosely scripted, highly choreographed sort of physical art form, kind of like a sweaty soap opera. Both the smarts and the marks can enjoy the wrestling, but they're enjoying fundamentally different shows. It's easy to see the world as a world run by smarts to take in the marks. It seems to be everywhere. You look at astrology and think there are more astrologers alive right now than there have been at all times in history combined. There are more professional astrologers in this country than there are astronomers. And in France, there are more astrologers than there are priests. Now, whether you think that's a good thing or a bad thing, it's an interesting thing. And then over here, we have all those psychic friends on the psychic friends networks talking about how they will read your heart, tell your future, while the small print at the bottom of the screen says, this service offered for entertainment only. It's the smarts and the marks. I don't need to finish the list. You can think of 15 more areas that run this way. Probably the sexiest of the bunch are all of the alien invasions and alien abductions to which we've been subjected over the last quarter of a century. They're really quite amazing. And I want to talk this morning only about two categories of balderdash because there's way too much to fit in a morning. But two categories that I think might show us something I think it's terribly important to understand about Balderdash. They both involve those aliens coming here. The first is crop circles, and the second are alien abductions. Now, crop circles began, we can date it, crop circles began showing up in the wheat fields of English farmers in 1976. Two men, Doug Bauer and Dave Chorley, thought that the UFO gullibles were too good to pass up and so designed a hoax to take them in. And late at night, they began making crop circles, which they'd drawn and sketched and sometimes made intricate watercolors of in advance. They took an old steel bar that one of them used to secure the back door of his framing shop, and with a steel bar, they went out in the fields and they flattened on some wheat in circles and made some designs. And then they waited, and nothing happened at first. Nobody noticed it. The UFO gullibles weren't interested. And even though they'd made crop circles for several months, it just looked like a hoax that wasn't going to catch on. They were on the verge of dropping this and moving on to some other more emotionally gratifying hoax when suddenly they caught on. The media swallowed it hook, line, and sinker. Crowds began to gather, and then the fun began. And it was the show of the smarts and the marks all over again, though without too many smarts. Dowsers authenticated the crop circles and said these are genuine crop circles. Done by aliens. Other experts swore that this was obviously the work of an intelligence far superior to merely human intelligence. Channelers, helpfully, contacted the entities responsible for the crop circles and told the press what they were saying. Some channelers contacted entities who were visitors from other planets. Some contacted the spirit of the Earth itself, complaining about our treatment of it. Some said that it's the devil who's angry at us and is doing these strange designs in the wheat fields. Well, Doug and Dave followed all the media reports with a lot of interest. They liked it especially when the experts said that this is clearly the work of intelligence far superior to humans. This motivated them to take the hokum up a couple steps, and they began making far more elaborate and intricate patterns. They even went from using just a steel bar to using planks and ropes. So they were getting into very sophisticated machinery for this. When a local meteorologist scoffed at it, saying that these are obviously merely the work of whirlwinds, since all of the wheat was flattened in a clockwise direction in the circle, the next time Doug and Dave went out, they made an inner circle with wheat flattened in a clockwise direction and outer circles flattened in counterclockwise directions. Now, before too long, there were copycat crop circle makers in other parts of England, and the things started appearing all over the country. Whereupon, Doug and Dave went out into the field, and they wrote, in English, "We are not alone." This was also interpreted by the experts as a message from aliens. Then Doug and Dave began signing their work with two D's, and this also was given an alien origin and an esoteric metaphysical meaning discovered through dowsers and channelers and some of the others among the psychically gifted, some of whom had said authoritatively that they had detected genuine orgone energy in the crop circles. And that apparently is a good thing. After not too many years, maybe 10, Doug's late-night disappearances began to make his wife, Eileen, suspicious. And she confronted him, and so, finally, in order to prove to Eileen that he was innocent, at least in this regard, Doug and Dave took Eileen with them one night as they made their crop circles. And then the next morning, Eileen joined the marks that gathered with the media to wonder at this latest visitation by aliens from outer space. However, by about 1991, Doug and Dave had grown tired of this. After all, they'd been doing it 15 years, and they were both in their 60s. So they confessed. They called the media. They told them what they'd done. They showed them the drawings. They showed them how they made crop circles. About 6 years after they confessed, some of these began making it to A&E and Discovery Channels. You may have seen the program on Doug and Dave out there making their circles and showing that the way that they find a straight line, which required superhuman and obviously alien intelligence, was that on the front of their baseball cap, they hung a little washer, and they would sight through that washer on one tree on the horizon and just keep walking toward that. That's how they made straight lines. I'm sure aliens could have done it in much more sophisticated ways. Now, you might think that would have ended the story, but it didn't, because the media make their money from the marks, not the smarts. So they paid very brief attention to this, and then began reporting on other crop circles in other parts of England, which they still attributed to alien invasions. Now, I wonder, how many here have heard of crop circles? Everybody's heard of crop. How many have heard the rest of the story that Doug and Dave did them? That's about a third. That's about a third. The marks won. Right. Finally, the public interest in crop circles died out, and they just stopped being made. The biggest show on this midway, though, has to be not just the alien invasions that write bizarre messages through geometric patterns in English wheat fields, but the alien abductions. Now, this is big stuff. It's taken a lot of attention, a lot of energy, a tremendous amount of media time, which lets you know that this is something for the marks. You don't sell commercial spots by reading from the Encyclopedia Britannica. You sell them by drawing a crowd. These aliens have been around for a long time. 100 years ago, they all came from Mars. They were little green men, and all the alien stories talked about them as being Martians. In the 1970s, after the Mariner space expedition showed that there was no water on Mars, the canals were not filled with water, and there was no sign of microbes either, then suddenly you stopped hearing about Martian invaders. And then all the space aliens were coming from Venus. But when another probe discovered that the surface temperature on Venus is hot enough to melt lead, then you stopped hearing about Venusian aliens, and they just became generic aliens from a galaxy long ago and far away. You could say that this started big time around 1947 when flying saucers were invented, after Roswell. But it really started, the business of alien abductions especially, really started in 1966 with the odd but now famous story of Betty and Barney Hill. This was a New Hampshire couple who got lost in the mountains one night. Years later, after much psychotherapy and hypnosis, they suddenly remembered that they hadn't just been lost in the mountains. They had been abducted by space aliens who took them up to the mothership, where they suffered unspeakable indignities, and then they were returned to Earth. This was like the crop circles. The media picked it up. It was wonderful. Television shows and movies were made. Barney Hill himself was played by James Earl Jones. This is top drawer stuff. Other people then began reporting that they had been abducted by space aliens, taken up to the mothership, seduced, and so forth. As a matter of fact, polls are now saying that about 1,000 Americans a year are abducted by space aliens. This is a pretty astonishing number. And a 1991 Roper poll, and who can you trust if you can't trust the Roper people, said that 5 million Americans have been abducted by aliens. 5 million. Now, if you do the math, That would mean it would actually take about 5,000 years at the rate of 1,000 a year to come up with 5 million abductees. And what this means, as you can tell, is that the number of alien abductions is being seriously underreported. The other big push that the space alien movement got was with Whitley Strieber's 1987 book, Communion. And it was the picture drawn for the cover of the book that showed us for the first time these little smooth, gray-faced, big-eyed aliens. And that's what space aliens in this society have looked like pretty much since then. They're not little green men anymore. They're little gray men with big eyes on this. Well, this goes on. And it looks like the Marx are running the whole show, as they do in wrestling and as they do in crop circles, or at least constituting the crowds. But behind the scenes, there are some smarts, and it's worth looking at a couple of them. One is a psychologist named Robert Baker, who has studied these things for years, written articles on it, and has concluded that of the space alien abductions, all of them fall into one of three categories. And they're interesting categories, especially the third one. First is that many of them are simply outright hoaxes, like the crop circles were. Second is that many more were suggested only through hypnosis and false memories. The third category was more interesting. And that's saying that those that weren't faked or suggested are an example of what is known in medical literature as sleep paralysis. Now, I'd never heard of this. Sleep paralysis involves part of the body's function that keeps us from thrashing around while we sleep and dream. In other words, you may dream that you're jumping over fences and running down streets, but if you were actually doing it, you'd be out of your bed and out the window and probably hit by a truck. So there is a mechanism in the body that lets us dream that we're moving wildly about while keeping us from moving at all. And sleep paralysis, they're saying, is a distortion of this and a malfunction of this. And what happens then is that you can wake up, you can see the room around you while your dream is still playing, but you can't move. They also report, I have no idea why, but it's a report that goes back, it looks like 2,000 to 3,000 years now. They also report that most of the people who report this also feel like there's a weight, a heavy weight on their chest. And about 85% of them think there's something ominous in the room, either something or someone in the room, which would make sense if you're feeling like you're seeing a dream playing and you cannot move. Now, if this is the case, now it suddenly starts looking familiar and looking like something that we can find throughout history. I'll give you a few examples. See whether you want to be with the Marx or the smarts on this. About 3,000 years ago in Mesopotamia, there was a goddess called Lamashtu, the most terrible of all goddesses. They said that she came to men in the night, terrified them, and bound their muscles so they could not move. Sound familiar? In the Middle Ages, in Europe, and in this country, in the 1600s and 1700s, you had a lot of cases reported as incubi and succubi, which were these little, they always seemed to be little, these little creatures who came in the night and would have sex with humans and then leave you exhausted. One of the most famous stories of this came from a Cornish teenager named Anne Jeffreys. In 1645, Anne was found unconscious and crumpled on the floor in her bedroom. And when she woke up, she remembered later that she had been abducted by six small men who had paralyzed her by touching her and carried her up to a castle in the air where she was seduced and then returned to Earth. Now, the next year, Anne Jeffreys was tried for witchcraft, which wouldn't be surprising in 1645. But think about her story. If Anne Jeffreys, she called these little men fairies, because in the 17th century, that's what they were called. Fairies were little men who could paralyze you with a touch. Fairies were reproductively challenged. And they often mated with humans in order to have offspring, and would sometimes leave one of their own misshapen offspring in its place, which were called changelings. So whole mythology existed in the 17th century for fairies. We don't know that much about fairies anymore. We don't talk about them, or changelings, or the rest. But if Anne Jeffries had lived today, her story would have been nearly identical with the stories of people who say they were abducted by one or six little men who carried them high in the air, not to a castle, but to the mothership, where they were seduced or subjected to various indignities and then returned back. Children of all ages have had imaginary playmates. We've all had them. Some of us still do, we just don't want to talk about them. But we've had elves and leprechauns and pixies and fairies and gremlins and goblins. We still see them in movies, we still draw them. They're such a part of our life, we don't even think of them as unusual. Now granted, there's a lot we don't know about psychology and imagination, and there's a lot that we don't know about aliens from galaxies far away, if there are any, and what they might do with a two-legged species from this planet. But if you had to bet, where would you put your money? Would you think there are two classes of children, say, one class that have imaginary playmates, elves, leprechauns, cartoon ducks, roadrunners, the whole thing, and another class of children who have real experiences with aliens, or that it's all one class of experiences which we interpret differently depending on where we live and when we live? One support from this comes from the fact that while in this country all the space aliens now seem to be a little smooth gray face with big eyes, that's not what they look like in other countries. In other countries, they're sometimes giant insects or robots. In one country, you can guess which part of the world, all the aliens tend to be blonde and blue-eyed. They look like depressingly local creations. Now, some people say that the business with space alien abductions, 1,000 a year or 5 million, is really just harmless fun, like professional wrestling. I don't agree, and I want to persuade you that it isn't harmless, even though it may be fun. Balderdash diverts energy and attention from real things to phony things. Balderdash numbs us rather than awakening us, and it transfixes us rather than transforming us. It's bogus religion, it's fool's gold, and it takes away energy that should be spent somewhere else. Some of this is shown even by the words that we've been using. Wrestling fans call them marks. Look up mark in the dictionary. Mark has two main meanings. A mark is a sign made in place of a real person. People who couldn't write would make their mark, an X on a legal contract. It's something that takes the place of a real person. And a mark is also a target, like a bullseye. You talk about hitting the mark, hitting the center of the target. And the marks in all these cases are being used in both senses. People are treated like things, and they're herded like animals around the latest media frenzy, and they're simply milked for money, energy, attention that I think should go somewhere else. The word magician is another one. The word comes from magi. The magi were the priests of Mithraism, the ancient religion of 2,000 years ago, an offshoot of Zoroastrianism. And the magi originally were people who could lead you into paths of wisdom and of insight. Look what's happened to the word. Now it just means somebody who can trick you. Same with the word wizard. wizard comes from a Middle English word that meant wise. Wizards were the people we would count to. In some of the women's spirituality groups, you'll talk about crones. It's the same kind of thing. The older people who have wisdom to share with us. We need that. Today, a wizard in a pointy hat is just another tricky fellow who fools you at carnivals. There's a tragedy going on in this deception. I think it's an important one. And that's that when we're diverted from what is real and what's important to what is merely titillating, we waste our energy and we waste our spirit that needs to be focused on trying to find authenticity rather than titillation. There is a tragedy. That wizard at the carnival in the story this morning really did have some things to teach the boy. He might have taught them there aren't any aliens up there drooling about the possibility of having sex with us. There aren't any elves or leprechauns running around or guardian angels. It's just us here, alone, sometimes frightened, looking for more of ourselves and more connections to others. The wizard might have taught him that what's within us is the capacity for both good and evil. And the task in life is acquiring the wisdom that lets us tell the difference. There really was something important that the boy needed to know. And he knew it. And so do we. That's why we work weekends.